Andy's going to speak now from that passage that Sue read, 1 Peter 3. Do keep it open if you'd like to. And the sort of little phrase that came out of that for me and has been around my thinking for a long time, indeed the thinking behind the whole of this weekend, are those two words, be prepared. In life, we prepare. You know, I'm going away on holiday tomorrow. I know some of you will say, what again? But going on holiday, I'm not prepared yet. And I've got to get prepared in order to go on holiday. And we prepare ourselves for all sorts of things all the time. The question is, as he said there, David Robertson said there, he's discovered that people are open to the gospel, but the church is not prepared. And so that's what this morning and this weekend has been about, helping us to be prepared so that when we get asked, we're prepared and ready to give an answer, a reason for our faith. So let's just pray. Lord, thank you for this morning. Thank you for your presence with us. Thank you that we have this opportunity to consider your word together now. And we pray that we would be hearers and doers of your word. Lord, let your word sink so deeply into our hearts and lives today that it produces fruit, and it produces it soon, and it produces it in season. To you be all the glory. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Andy.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for that introduction. And again, thank you for that that warm welcome. I was saying to a few folks yesterday that this part of the world actually does feel partly like home, because although my wife and I and two small kids, we now live in Dundee in Scotland. So, Bill, wherever you are, thank you for that Scottish accent. It felt like home. And we did live in Cheney's, just a few miles away, for many kind of years. So we know this part of the Chilterns kind of quite well. So it's great to be back here and to have been spending the weekend here at Seer Green. If you want to find out more about some of the stuff we do at Solas, little housekeeping announcement before we begin the message. On the table at the back there, we have a copy of our magazine, Solas Magazine. We have a few left from yesterday. That's free this morning. It does say £3.75 on the cover. Ignore that. It's our gift to you this morning. And if you really don't have enough of my puns and bad humour by the end of this morning, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist is my new book that's out on the back there. And also my colleague and I have just edited this book, Why We Still Believe, which is still hot off the press. I believe in it, even Amazon don't have copies yet. So there we are, launched in Seer Green before Amazon got their hands on it. Now, one of the privileges of working for the organisations that I do, as Andrew kind of intimated there, I get a lot of opportunity to travel around the world, and which is quite amazing for somebody who 10 years ago would never set foot on an aircraft. I was sort of terrified of flying, probably because every plane I'd ever been on was Ryanair, and it puts the fear of God into most people. Now I travel quite a lot, and that means I often get kind of messages and correspondence after I speak from people I've spoken to other parts of the world. And I'd like to begin this morning's message just by reading you an email that I received a few weeks ago from somebody who I forget where I'd met them, but they wanted to share part of their story with me. And I have permission to share this, by the way. Don't feel if you email me after events, I'll then read it out at the next sermon I preach. But I thought it was a lovely story. It starts a bit weird. Stick with it, because it's quite a rambling story. But the point they make is, I think, a great one to start with this morning. So this friend of mine, writes and says, as a bagpiper, and there we go, Scottish connection there for you. As a bagpiper, I was recently asked by a funeral director to play at a graveside service in eastern Connecticut in the USA for a homeless man who had recently died, and this man had no family or friends. The funeral was to be held at a cemetery in the remote countryside, and this man was going to be the first to be laid to rest there. Well, I was not familiar with that part of the countryside, and I quickly became lost, and being a typical man, did not stop to ask for directions. Never happens. I finally arrived an hour late. I saw the digger, the tractor, and the crew who were already eating lunch, but the hearse was nowhere in sight. Well, I apologized to the workers for my tardiness, and I stepped to the side of the open grave where I could see the vault lid on the coffin was already in place. I assured the workers I would not hold them up for long, but that this was the proper thing to do. The workers gathered around, still eating their lunch, as I began to play the bagpipes, and I played out my heart and my soul. As I played, the workers began to weep. I played and I played like I've never played before. I played Going Home, I played The Lord is My Shepherd, I played Flowers of the Forest. I closed the lengthy session with amazing grace, and I walked quietly back to my car. As I was opening the door and taking off my coat, I overheard one of the workers saying to another, "Sweet Jesus, Mary and Joseph, I've never seen anything like that in my entire life, and I've been putting in septic tanks for 20 years. That's terrible. Gotcha. I start with that terrible, terrible story that some of you are looking at and thinking, Andrew, never invite this man ever again. Because part of what that story illustrates, I think, is one of the problems that the church has in the culture. That we say one thing, and we think we're being heard, but actually we're communicating right past people. Just as that bagpipe player thought that the cemetery workers were enjoying, you know, this wonderful sort of, a send-off for this man, when actually there's been a huge communication mistake. And so much, I think, of evangelism, sometimes if we don't stop and think about it, can end up in communication mistakes. And that's kind of really what we want to avoid, and I want us to think about it a little bit this morning. Now, I actually have Muslims to thank for my being an evangelist and an apologist. In the late 1990s, I was a youth worker working for a group of churches in London. And if any of you have done any youth work in your lives, you will know that all you need for really effective youth work is a Bible and a really sharp stick. A cattle prod, actually, depending on the kind of young people you're working with. Never really thought about evangelism, never really thought about sharing my faith much. And then I stumbled one day into a seminar on Islam that was being taught at my church. We had a gentleman visiting, in fact, the man with the glasses on the left-hand side of the screen. His name is Jay Smith. He's one of the Christian world's most effective evangelists we have in the West at reaching Muslims. And he was giving this seminar to this church I was attending. I went and listened to his seminar, and it was captivating. It was really interesting what he was sharing. And in particular, he told how he was going every Sunday afternoon to Speaker's Corner, Hyde Park in London. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. It's an interesting place to go. You can stand on a ladder or a box, or if you're as short as me, two boxes and a ladder. And I saw who laughed. And you could speak about anything, religion, politics, and sport, you name it. Well, Jay and his friends were using it as a platform to reach Muslims. They were having hundreds of Muslims come and hear them speak and share the gospel. And so I got talking to him after the seminar, and he said to me, why don't you come to Speaker's Corner next week? Come and see what we do. So I turned up at Marble Arch Tube Station the following Sunday to be met by Jay with two ladders. I said, why have you got two ladders? He said, one is for you. I said, I thought you said come and see. He went, oh, preaching on the street is easy. I said, I've never preached on the street before. He said, oh, no, you'll take to it like a duck to water. I said, I've never talked to Muslims before. He said, oh, they are the easiest people to talk to. He was wrong on both counts, I tell you, because I got on that ladder, and my new Muslim friends, about 100 of them that day, they had questions, they had objections, they were well-trained in taking down Christians. And I remember getting down from the ladder thinking, I need to become a Muslim, because they have all of the answers and great beards, and I have nothing. And so I went home on the train, sort of rather depressed, worrying about this, lay awake that night, worrying about this. About 3 a.m, my long-suffering wife pokes me in the ribs and says, Andy, why are you tossing and turning, keeping us both awake? I told her my sad little story, and her wise words were, why don't you read a book, ideally in the morning, not at, 3 a.m. So the following morning, I went to the local Christian bookstore, I told them my dilemma, and they said, well, what you need is apologetics. I said, apologetics? I thought it sounded like a breakfast cereal. A double helping of wheaty apologetics every morning will keep you regular. No, they said, it's the part of the, Christian faith concerned with giving answers why we believe. And they directed me to this silly, dark, spider-infested part of the bookshop. And I bought my first ever book on answering people's questions about faith. It was by C.S. Lewis, who I'm sure many of you have heard of. I read that. I read more. I read solidly, actually, for 2 weeks. Went back to Speaker's Corner with answers to all of their questions. And they had new questions. And they made me look stupid all over again. And so we repeated this exercise for the next 3 months. I would go to Speaker's Corner on a Sunday afternoon. I would be humiliated in public, and I would come home, read, and so forth. But over that time, God did something quite interesting. He gave me a love of Muslims. I have a problem with Islam, but I love Muslims. Gave me a love of sharing my faith in public and a love of answering people's questions. And so God used very surprising ways, Muslims and their questions, to draw me into the kind of ministry that I'm doing today. And this little word apologetics I just mentioned is vital, really. Vital for every Christian, actually. Whether you're going to end up in, or you are in, full-time Christian ministry, or whether you're simply wanting to talk to your friend or your neighbor or your family member about what you believe. Because, as I say, apologetics is just this branch of Christian theology concerned with explaining why we are Christians, giving that reason for the hope that we have. And the interesting thing is, if I asked each of you in the church this morning, why are you a Christian this morning, we probably get a variety of answers. I imagine every one of you here who would call yourself a Christian has different answers, different stories about how you came to Christian faith. But I wonder, as we think about this for a moment, that I wonder if you've ever realized that there are, in fact, three main reasons why people make decisions, whether it's the decision to follow Jesus, whether it's the decision to vote for a political leader, or to choose a particular career, or to appoint a particular minister. I don't know how that happens, but, you know, there we are. Based on he should never sit on the front row of my sermons, my friend. Based on three reasons. There are three reasons people make any decision. People make decisions for intellectual reasons. People make decisions for emotional reasons. And people make decisions based on what other people think. So, for example, we come and we hear a compelling speaker give a very logical set of reasons why we should do something, and we're persuaded, and people make decisions for that reason. Or perhaps we come and hear somebody preach in church on Sunday. They're a visiting preacher. They're very attractive. They're very funny. They're very charismatic. Thank you, a few people who are nodding. And we go, yes, I think what Andy said was broadly right. Or perhaps we think to ourselves, you know what? You know, somebody I admire is a Christian. You know, C.S. Lewis, or, you know, John Lennox, or, you know, Dorothy Sayers, or somebody who we admire, and we think, you know, that's a good reason to take Christianity seriously. And those are all good reasons. But the interesting thing is, I think the church over the last few years has been particularly good at the last two on that list, and not so good at the first one. Maybe you've heard sermons where the pastor has said something like, you know, follow Jesus, and you will feel good and happy and fulfilled and full of joy and so forth. And in one sense, there's nothing wrong with that. As I say, I also know people who follow Jesus because people they admire, or friends or family members do, and there's nothing entirely wrong with that. But this first category, you know, intellectual reasons why we should take Christianity seriously, we sometimes in recent years in the church had a tendency to neglect those. And I want to suggest to us this morning, we do that at our peril. Let me point out why. And one reason why, for example, is when Jesus was once asked what the greatest commandment was, if you remember, in Matthew chapter 22, this is what Jesus said. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your soul. This is the first and the greatest commandment. So Jesus is very clear, right? We must love God not just with our hearts and not just with our souls, but also with our minds as well. And why did Jesus say that? Well, I think for a number of reasons. One reason is if we don't, there are a number of traps, I think, that we can fall into as Christians that can have slightly unfortunate consequences. For example, if we neglect the Christian mind, if we don't apply our minds to our faith as much as our hearts and our souls, if we're not careful, our faith can just become blind faith. We see this in some degree in Islam. My academic work is actually in Islam. My PhD is in Islamic studies, not Christian theology. And in Islam, I don't know how much you know about the Muslim faith, everything hangs purely on the testimony of Muhammad. In fact, I once heard a leading Muslim religious leader on BBC Radio 4 once say, he said, in Islam, we don't follow anyone blindly except Muhammad. And I kind of thought, that's a great quote. I proceeded to write that down. Now, biblical faith, on the other hand, is not like that. In the Bible, the word faith actually means trust. It's actually the same in English, actually. In the English language, we've sort of forgotten that. The word faith comes from the Latin word fides, that means trust. And the Bible tells the story of why God is trustworthy, ultimately because of what he's done in Jesus. And then the response is we are asked to put our trust in him because of what he's done. But the Bible is also very clear, and we'll see this in a moment when we dive into this passage that was just read to us so beautifully, that if we are asked why we are Christians, the Bible says we ought to be able to give reasons and not just say, oh, we believe because we believe. So that's one problem. Second problem, if we neglect the Christian mind, we risk, if we're not careful, dividing the sacred from the secular. religious faith, our Christian faith, can become for some of us a private matter. In fact, the world we live in encourages us to, you know, believe what you want at home, just don't bring it into the, you know, workplace. And if we're not careful, that happens to us as Christians. Our Christian faith becomes something we do on Sunday. And I would suggest that perhaps the church right now, maybe we have few too many Sunday Christians kicking around whose faith in Jesus doesn't actually affect Monday through Saturday. But of course, if the gospel is true, it affects everything, right? If the gospel is true, it should affect every aspect of life. We need Christians who are gifted politicians and writers and teachers and engineers and computer programmers and so on and so forth who can show in their Monday through Saturday existence how the gospel is true about how they live and how they work. As C.S. Lewis, who I mentioned a few moments ago, famously said, he said, "I believe in Christianity in the same way as I believe the sun has risen. Not because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." In other words, if Christianity is true, if the gospel is true, it should change every aspect of our lives, not just our quote-unquote spiritual lives. And ensuring that we cultivate the life of the mind and think a bit more about our faith is one way to ensure that this plays out. Thirdly, if we neglect the mind, if we neglect that commandment of Jesus to love the Lord with our mind as well as our hearts and our souls, the gospel can quickly end up just becoming about felt needs. I end up becoming a Christian because it makes me feel good. I come to church on Sunday and I listen to the worship band play and I get the warm fuzzies. And it's fantastic. I float an inch above the floor and it's phenomenal. I feel good. And that's great if coming to church on Sunday does that. But I wonder if you've ever realized or appreciated that whether or not the gospel makes you feel good is actually largely irrelevant. What actually matters is whether the gospel is true. In fact, interestingly, if you take the words of Jesus seriously, becoming a Christian is at times likely to make you feel awful. Jesus said, "Take up your cross and follow me." That's generally not a recipe for sort of, you know, rainbows and unicorns and kittens. But we live in a world that's increasingly feelings-driven. You know, whether it's the news or the media or advertising, you know, we're told, bought, buy this product, sign up for this social media site and so on and so forth, you'll be happy and fulfilled. And increasingly, religion and spirituality in our culture is sold to us this way. There are 1,001 gurus and religious figures out there who will tell you, believe what I believe, follow my way, and life will be wonderful. I think we need to be quite suspicious of that trap as Christians. If you read the book of Acts, for example, and you look at the preaching of the first Christians, of Peter and James and John and, of course, Paul, what do you find? You find they base their evangelism purely on this. This is true. Christ really rose from the dead, so believe, even if life may be a bit tough afterwards. And then finally, before we dig into 1 Peter 3 for a few moments, if we neglect the life of the mind, I think one of the problems is that we lose a little bit of boldness in our preaching and our evangelism, and we will fail to address the big sort of idea structures in our culture. And in the West, that's largely secularism and materialism, this belief writ large across the British culture right now that says that you are what you own, that there is no God, that everything is just atoms and particles and chemicals. Although equally, of course, other religions like Islam are growing rapidly too. Now, if we're going to respond to our secular friends, if we're going to respond to our Muslim friends and those in other faiths, simply saying, well, you know, Christianity makes me feel good, or, you know, I believe because the pastor told me to, it's not going to work. We actually need to be able to say, well, the reason I think that Christianity is true and atheism is false is because of. We need to display good reasons as well as spiritual authority. And one of the things I've found since beginning to do this more public form of evangelism that the Lord called me into is that once you begin to know what, not just what you believe, but why you believe it, you become a lot more confident in your evangelism. Okay, you maybe get frustrated that somebody doesn't believe the same as you, but it doesn't sort of wobble you in such the same way because you know that there are reasons why the gospel is true, and it will give much more confidence to your evangelism. Now, as I say, when we get to the Christian mind and to evangelism, we very quickly get into this whole area of apologetics, this word I mentioned a few moments ago. And apologetics, it's one of those long-sounding, complicated theological words just because theologians like to feel they're earning their money. But it really just means giving a reason why you believe what you believe as a Christian. And it's an idea that comes right out of the Bible, out of this passage that was read to us a few minutes ago. Let's just remind ourselves, particularly about verses 15 and 16 of 1 Peter chapter 3, where Peter writes, "But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give a reason for to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you profess. But do this with gentleness and respect." And in the kind of last sort of half of my sermon this morning, I really want to think about how can this passage in particular help us as we think about giving a reason for our hope, about sharing our faith with our friends, neighbours, colleagues, classmates, unbelieving family members, and so forth. Well, a couple of things generally about 1 Peter as an epistle in the New Testament, and then four very brief ideas I want to fish out of the passage here for you. A couple of general statements first of all. First thing it's important to notice is that 1 Peter, as a book, is a little bit unusual in the New Testament in that it's written to the whole church. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but if you look at a lot of books in the New Testament, especially the letters, they're written to particular groups of people or to churches, right? 1 and 2 Corinthians are written to the Corinthians. Philippians is written to the church at Philippi. Timothy is written to Timothy, and so on and so forth. See how easy it is to be a Bible scholar? We don't need theology degrees. You just read the first two verses. Now, Peter, on the other hand, is interesting, because if you read the introduction to 1 Peter, you'll discover he's writing to the whole church. He's writing to all Christians everywhere. And I find that interesting for this reason. You see, sometimes we can, as Christians, end up with slightly skewed impression of evangelism. And it goes like this. Maybe if we think about evangelism, we find ourselves thinking, well, maybe evangelism is something for specialists. You know, praise the Lord that he sent Billy Graham so I don't have to do it. Or we think, it's not my gift. You know, my gift is baking cakes or setting out chairs or hammering in nails. Anything, Lord, but evangelism. I'll do anything. Please, just, Lord, don't call me to share my faith with the next door neighbor. Or maybe the thinking goes this way. You know, evangelism means plucking up the courage to invite, bribe, or manipulate my next door neighbor to come to church on Sunday, and then I'm going to pray till 3 a.m. on Sunday morning that Andrew does a really good job in his sermon on Sunday morning and leads them to Christ. And if they don't come to Christ in that sermon, well, it wasn't my fault, it was his fault, because I darn well got them there. And that's how I think some of us, sometimes, if we're honest, think a little bit about evangelism. But there's 1,001 problems with that model. The biggest problem is this. Every Christian has people in their lives, I believe, for whom they may be the only Christian, you may be the only Christian that they know, especially in this secular culture we live in. You may have family members or friends or neighbors or colleagues who you may actually be the only genuine Christian they know, which sort of raises the imperative and raises the stakes slightly. Because if you don't share the gospel with them, who is going to? And thus I think the very fact that Peter writes this command about evangelism to the entire church is interesting, because it doesn't let us off the hook. All of us have to think about it. Second point about the book as a whole, and then we'll just take a brief look at the verse. It's interesting to observe that 1 Peter is written to a church that was being persecuted. Look at the background to this book. This was written during the waves of persecution that the Roman Empire unleashed on the early church. And in the first few centuries of the church, Christians regularly faced pretty extreme and hostile persecution from the Roman Empire. For example, the Romans would regularly round Christians up and insist that they denied Christ and worshipped the emperor. And if you didn't do that, then you would face arrest, certainly imprisonment, and quite frankly, probably execution. Now, the interesting thing is, given that context, if it had been me, not Peter, writing this epistle, I think I'd have softballed it slightly. I'd have said, you know, okay, folks, it's a little bit dangerous right now. Nero's on the rampage, so here's what we'll do. We'll hide, you know, in the doors of our house churches. We'll hide out in those catacombs in Rome. And once the Roman Empire has moved on and sort of been, you know, no longer bothered about us, then we'll launch the Alpha Course. But until then, shh. That's what you'd have had in 1 Peter if I'd been writing it. Peter doesn't write that. Rather, he says, be open about what you believe. Give a reason for the hope that you have. You could have lost your life in the first century for following this command. And I find that sobering and a little bit of a wake-up call, because we can sometimes buy into the idea that, you know, it's tough to be a Christian here in the UK. And you know what? That's true. It is a little bit tough here to be a Christian in the UK. But right now, we don't lose our lives for being Christians or sharing Jesus. Okay, somebody may look at us a bit funny. or make a joke about us, or maybe we might miss out on that promotion at work, or you know, a friendship might be a little bit tense at times. But when we look at what our brothers and sisters went through, who first founded the church, who Jesus, through the power of the Spirit, used to begin that great missionary movement that within 300 years had seen 50% of the Roman Empire become Christians, it's sobering and a challenge, I think, to each of us to ask, really, are we willing to pay that price for evangelism? Or are we too, perhaps, comfortable in our middle-class Christianity that we'd rather not bother? Challenging and sobering question to ask ourselves at times. So those comments aside, let's take a quick look then at 1 Peter 3, verse 15 and 16. Just four brief wee points I want to bring out of here as we sort of bring this in for a close and help us think about these things as we focus on this passage. First thing that intrigues me in 1 Peter 3, 15, to say a few words about, it's interesting to say that Peter begins here this very famous Bible verse about giving an answer about evangelism by saying that all of this begins when we set apart Christ as Lord of our hearts. In other words, Peter is saying the Lordship of Christ is foundational. There's no point thinking about evangelism if Jesus isn't Lord, because we have nothing to share. And Lordship is interesting, right, because I meet so many people who think that Christian faith is just the sort of set of beliefs that you sign up to or a set of morals that you keep. That's certainly most of my secular friends. Many of my Muslim friends think this. And I'm always pulling people back to verses like this one and saying, no, Christian faith is ultimately a lordship question. It's who's in charge. Is Jesus in charge or am I in charge of my life? And the lordship of Christ means that every part of our lives needs to be under the authority of Jesus. If there is some part of our hearts, some part of our lives, some part of who we are that we haven't laid at the foot of the cross, then our apologetics, our evangelism, will ultimately be in vain. And not all who profess Christ possess Christ. And thus apologetics and evangelism is ultimately a spiritual discipline. It flows out of the place that Christ has in our lives. And so the first question to ask ourselves, if we want to be more effective witnesses, more effective ambassadors for Christ, is to daily ask ourselves that question. Jesus, are you really Lord? Is there some part of my life that I haven't handed over to you? Then in which case, will you show me so I can take my hands off that part of my life and give it to you? In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Next, Peter says, always be prepared. Now, interestingly, this word, this phrase, be prepared, is the English translation of a little Greek word which was actually used in the first century in the Greco-Roman world to describe the sort of preparation that athletes would go through as they prepared for the Olympic Games. Now, any of you in this room who are sporty in any way or have been sporty in the past will know that it's one thing to get fit, it's another thing to stay fit. I remember actually my wife and I learning this lesson the hard way, and she's looking at me from the front row going, what story are you about to tell? When we first moved to Canada, back in 2010, we discovered some amazing shopping experiences there. I mean, you think Argos is impressive. It's got nothing on what the Canadians offer. There are stores there where you can buy everything. I used to joke to my wife, we could go into our local branch of what was called Canadian Tire and probably buy a nuclear submarine. It would be on a shelf somewhere. Anyway, we went into this store one day shortly after arriving in Canada and being taken in by the whole North American lifestyle, and they had a discount. They had a sale on exercise equipment. And so we came back with an exercise bike. We came back with a sort of one of these sort of walking machines like this. We installed them in the basement. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, we were down there most evenings. And I ended up looking much sort of slimmer than I am now. It's amazing what you can do with a garter under your shirt. And I got fit. I actually got fit probably the first time in my life. But then there was a problem. I discovered something else that the Canadians specialize in. Donuts. And all of that kind of good work disappeared under a wave of the most incredible donuts called the Boston Cream Donut, which I actually think was invented in heaven by angels, but, you know, there you are. I discovered that there is a difference between getting fit and staying fit. And actually, the same is true spiritually. You know, it's possible to come along to church on Sunday, get really excited by the worship and the sermon and all fired up, and then by Monday morning, it's all sort of fizzled away, and you're back into the sort of doldrums of the Monday through Friday existence. Or you can, you know, go on, you know, attend a Christian conference, go to Spring Harvest or whatever sort of, you know, sort of floats your particular boat, and the same thing happens. You know, we get fired up, we get to the top of the mountain, and then we come back again, and it all fades away the next day. It's staying fit is always the hardest part. When it comes to evangelism, this is what the Bible, this is what Peter is saying here. He's saying if we're really going to engage the world with the truth of the gospel, if we're going to listen to it, if we're going to engage our friends' questions and obstructions, things that are keeping them from the Christian faith, it's going to take work. It's going to take effort. We need to invest in relationships. We need to ask good questions. We need to become good listeners. We need to find out what are the stumbling blocks that prevent our friends from taking the claims of the gospel seriously. And then we need to do the work. We need to do the hard work of studying the scriptures. We may need to do the hard work of reading and thinking. We may need to come and book an appointment with a pastor and say, "Pastor, my friend has this question. Can you help me answer it?" And invest that time. Are we getting prepared? Are we really prepared to put the effort in so we can commend the faith to those around us? Responding to our culture, responding to our friends, whether they are spiritually seeking or whether they appear to be spiritually closed, is going to require hard work. Are we willing to be prepared? And then penultimately, we come to this key phrase, give a reason. And the Greek word used here in 1 Peter 3:15 is the Greek word apologia, from where we get the word apologetics. And Peter is very clear. Believing in Jesus Christ is not superstition. Believing in Jesus is not something that we believe because we believe because we believe. You know, I meet so many people in our culture who think that Christian faith is blind faith, who think that we just believe in the way that, you know, people believe in Father Christmas and the tooth fairies. But this is, you know, not the biblical idea of faith. The Bible is very clear that faith is a gift, but it is not the gift of stupidity. And as Christians, we are commended to think through and to put, and as I said earlier, the word faith means to put your trust in. And it's interesting, I have trust in my wife, I have faith in my wife. And if you ask me why, I would give you reasons why I trust in Astrid. And that's how the Bible talks about God. Here is what God has done in history. Here is what God has done in Jesus Christ. And when you say, "I have faith in God," what we are saying as Christians is I actively trust in somebody who is real and whose character and whose actions are trustworthy. And that's why I can give a reason for my hope to those who ask. And a good question to think about this morning, if somebody were to come to you in the week and look at you and say, "Hey, you're a Christian, aren't you? Why are you one?" What answer would you give them? Could you give somebody a reason for your faith and for your hope? If you can, that's great. If not, I'm not. My job this morning is not to make you feel bad, but it is to shake you up a bit and challenge you and go, okay, maybe begin thinking that through. What's the reason I would give to that person? And then lastly, finally, we come to this last part of the verse. Do this with gentleness and respect. You know, it's interesting that ultimately people will judge the truth of our words and what we say about the gospel by our characters and our actions. The simple fact is that how we live our lives out as Christians will directly affect how seriously people take our message. Conversely, by the way, just living your life out as a nice person without sharing Jesus is actually largely ineffective. People just see you as a nice person. They won't necessarily see you as a Christian. But if we're going to commend Jesus, we need to have our lives live out and demonstrate the gospel that we proclaim. And we are called as Christians, as brothers and sisters here, to live that life reflecting Jesus, that when people hear us talk about him, there is a connection between our lives and what we say. You know, our skeptical friends, our non-Christian friends, are surprisingly good at spotting hypocrisy. And I say that's actually a wonderful gift, actually, to have people around you who can smell hypocrisy, because it's one of the things Jesus was most concerned about. You know, and as the British evangelist Gypsy Smith over 100 years ago once famously put it, he said, you know, there are not four Gospels, there are five Gospels. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the life of the individual Christian. Most people won't bother reading the first four. So, in conclusion, apologetics then, giving a reason for your hope, engaging with the questions that people ask, is crucial to evangelism. Jesus said, as we looked at the start, love the Lord your God with your heart, with your mind, with your soul. If we're going to impact our culture for Christ, if we're going to see God move in a village like Seer Green, in our bigger towns, in our counties, in our lands, then we need to be able to using our hearts and our minds and our souls. We must engage people's minds. We must have hearts of compassion. And only when we do that are we going to win people's souls. Souls, hearts, and minds. The Christian mind is vital to evangelism. It's also, interestingly, vital to discipleship. Because in Romans chapter 12, verse 2, the Apostle Paul wrote these words. He said, "Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's through the renewing of the mind and the warming of the heart and the healing of the soul that Christ does his work in us. And renewing and feeding and nurturing the Christian mind is a vital part of discipleship. That's one of my favorite Christian philosophers, J.P. Moreland, once wrote. He said, a growing, vibrant disciple will be somebody who values their intellectual life and works at developing their mind carefully. My prayer for each one of you this morning, I don't know what your Monday through Saturday lives looks like, but my prayer for each one of you this morning is that those of you who know and love Jesus will be growing, vibrant disciples. In fact, the prayer I'd like to pray for you comes directly from what Jesus said in Matthew 5:16, where he said, wherever God has placed you, wherever God has placed you, or is calling you to be, I pray for each of you this morning that your light may shine before others, that they may see your good deeds, and I might add, hear your good words, and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Thank you for listening this morning. Andrew.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Could you, before you close that down,
yes,
go back to the 1 Peter slide?
I could indeed. Hang on a minute. We just need to put the technology guys are one step ahead of us.
Sorry.
Look at that. That's great. Look at that.
I just want to... We had some great opportunity over this weekend to
have some debate and discussion with Andy. So the last four talks that he's given, we've always had that opportunity for Q&A, and we've had some great discussions. We've only got a minute or two, but is there anybody who's got a burning question that they want to ask before we come to a conclusion? Is it succinct? Go on. A burning question.
A burning question. Yes.
Andy, right. Thank you very much.
What's your name, by the way?
It's Flavia.
Flavia.
Yes. Thank you very much. And I missed yesterday and I'm gutted, really, but I'm going to listen to the record. It was quite interesting because we had a chat, Andy and I, because I have a patient that it was going to trouble, and I was trying to introduce Jesus back into his life.
Yes.
And he was asking me lots of questions, and I was able to answer, you know, a few of them. But then he said, yeah, but where was God when the Texas incident at the Baptist church happened? It was the church before they're trusting God.
Yeah.
They trust God. And where was he? Why? Because if I see a child endangered, I would throw myself to protect that child. Why did God not do that?
That's a great question, and a hugely important one. Actually, we said yesterday that the questions around suffering and evil and tragedy are actually some of the most common questions that I think that people have. Yeah. Yeah. So what I would say to your friend, to your patient, a couple of things. I think a great place to begin, we said this yesterday, is that comparing and contrasting is always helpful. So here's the first thing I would want to say. I'd say it's interesting, isn't it, that built into your patient's question is the idea that a human life has value, whether it's the life of a child or the life of somebody who's lost their life in a tragedy like that. Built into his question is the assumption that human life is valuable and precious, and such that something wrong has happened when a life is lost or a life is taken. That's otherwise, there's no question, right? So I'd start with him there. That leads to the question, well, why? Because if there is no God, let's just take God out of the picture for a moment. Let's imagine that there is no God, that we live in a godless universe where nothing more is happening than the motions of atoms and particles. Then the life of a child, the life of an adult, has no value. You are just a collection of atoms, just like this is a collection of atoms. And in that kind of world, what does it matter if somebody dies, somebody shoots somebody else? What's the problem? So it's all just atoms bubbling in motion. If, on the other hand, human beings actually bear value, if human beings are made in the image of God, for instance, as the Bible says, then actually life is precious. You have dignity, you have infinite value, and thus a real wrong has been done, a real crime has been committed, a real injustice is done when somebody takes somebody else's life. That's where I'd begin, because his very recognition that something wrong has happened only works in the Christian worldview. So interestingly, he's actually closer to Christianity than he realizes. That's the first thing I'd say. Secondly, I'd want to say to him, it's interesting that one thing that Christians have lived with and wrestled with right from the very beginning of the Christian faith, this is not a new one, is that being a Christian does not automatically exempt you from the fact that the world is a broken, messed up place. Christianity is not like some great life, you know, sort of, not even life insurance policy, more like the mafia, really. You know, you believe in God and it's okay, God's there to go, okay, I'll stop nasty people hurting you, I'll stop rocks falling on your head, I'll stop diseases and so forth. Right from the word go, in fact, this morning when I talked about 1 Peter, you know, that was written to a church who was suffering persecution, the Roman Empire, killing Christians. Nero particularly, the Emperor Nero, was brutal. Was famous for tying Christians to fence posts, covering them in tar and setting light to them and using them as torches at his garden parties. And to go for Christian faith to begin in that context, as Christians have always known about suffering, we've always known that we live in a world that is broken and that the world is not as it should be. So that then raises the question of, has God just sat by and done nothing? Do we worship a God who sits up there in heaven going, well, I'm just going to watch it all go wrong and I'm glad I'm here in heaven, not down there. It's a right old mess. Well, that's not the God of the Bible, is it? We have the God who has stepped into history in the person of Jesus, not just done something about suffering and evil, but has experienced suffering and evil, paid with every drop of his blood and the last beat of his heart to actually deal once and for all with the problem of evil and begin putting the world right again. But it's because of Jesus that we have that hope that when God finally wraps up history, that there will be justice and there will be everything will be put right. But God is a God of action, not a God of inactivity. So I'd begin with the fact that only Christianity makes sense of human value in the first place. I would then look at the fact that Christians have always been aware of this. This is not a new question. And then lastly, I don't know what God has done in Jesus. So I'd sort of stitch those things together into some kind of answer. Does that help to some degree? Okay, thank you for that question.